This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Isn't it equal?
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here in the studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II.
Happy belated Canada Day.
All right. It is Canada Day this week, and happy premature 4th of July. I'm not sure I knew exactly that the two countries share independence celebrations quite as closely as they do. And what we want to talk about today is a connection, I guess, between those two countries, and that is in the treatment by both nations of indigenous peoples, the people who were here when European settlers arrived. Canada has undergone a truth and reconciliation effort with regard to the way it mistreated indigenous people and come up with a long list of 94 calls to action to try to make up for those wrongs. Anyone who lives here knows we haven't done anything approaching that in America.
You know, I was disappointed to discover how much I didn't know about the indigenous history of the country north of us. I didn't know about the residential schools. I didn't know about truth and reconciliation. So I'm looking forward to learning more and sharing more with our audience. What about you, Stephen? Was this a part of your knowledge growing up? Did you already know about this?
It wasn't. I mean, I don't know much about Canada and its history. And so I'm really eager to talk with Dr. Tricia Logan, who's from the University of British Columbia. She's our guest. She's a scholar who's got experience working with Indigenous communities and residential school survivors in Canada. I want to learn more from her about what happened there and especially how they chose to deal with this, how they chose to confront this, and whether it's actually working. I mean, there's a lesson there for Americans, I think. Dr. Tricia Logan, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I want to start with a quote and then a question. And here's the quote. It says, "If anything is to be done with the Indian, we must catch him very young. The children must be kept constantly within the circle of civilized conditions." Now, I think that quote really characterizes the Canadian government's ideas about Indigenous people, the threat that they posed to colonialism and colonial instincts, and the mission that that countries like Canada had to assimilate Indigenous people into European culture. Shortly after this kind of idea comes about, the government establishes these residential schools. I want to talk about who ran these schools, what they were, and why they played such an important role in the idea of truth and reconciliation in Canada.
Sure. It's a long history in Canada, but it's part of what made Canada the way it is today.
So let's talk about who ran these residential schools and who came up with the idea that this was the way to do this.
From the start, it was always a joint partnership between the growing nation of Canada before Canada even became Canada, when it was still the Dominion and a British colony, and churches that had presence in Canada since the 1500s, 1600s, Protestant and Catholic church entities had set up missions all across Canada. And, you know, there was this kind of expectant capitalism of the fur trade and timber and kind of colonial incursions into Canada. And through that partnership, it was built on a system of industrial boarding schools, industrial kind of residential schools, based on a very European, Western European model that was seen in the United States and in different colonial contexts as well, in Sweden, in Russia, these ideas of forcibly removing indigenous children from their homes and from their families to assimilate, Christianize, and quote unquote civilize populations, generations of indigenous children, with the kind of the impetus that the effort from the government to quote unquote settle and to kind of extract resources, to obtain land, to give land, to kind of transfer land from what they thought was very, what would have been thought of as kind of heathen or savage use of the land, to agrarian kind of agricultural, more European style of using the land and doing that. There were a lot of very violent means to do that. And one of the ways was through a residential boarding school system. There were officials that went into the United States in the late 1800s to look at the boarding school system that was operating there and reported back to the government of Canada and implemented a very similar system, analogous to a lot of these kind of workhouse, boarding school, industrial mm-hmm. school styles, thinking that good work, good hard work will make, and good Christian, Catholic, or Protestant work will make good Canadian citizens.
Yeah. We should talk about the living conditions in these schools, as you point out. These were more like work camps, I think, is maybe an accurate way to describe them than they were schools or educational settings. Is that fair?
That's fair, yes. When I'm, and I should preface this by saying, when I'm kind of making broad statements about the system in Canada and what the conditions were like, I received a lot of this history from residential school survivors, First Nations and Métis and Inuit people who attended the schools. It was a lot of my work for the last 25 years has been to record testimonies from survivors, and often what they tell, what their recollection is of kind of day-to-day life inside the schools. And I think this was generations of kids' experience, is they remember work, then they remember prayer, and they remember church indoctrination, most as well as kind of very horrific experiences of physical and sexual abuse. I think the day-to-day life, the conditions that people reflect on and remember as a child are about work and often forced labor. It was large farms, large agricultural farms with livestock and grains and gardens. And some had kind of blacksmith shops and carpentry and sewing and laundry, where a lot of that labor and some of it that produced vegetables and grains and livestock, a lot of that production went to kind of cooperative farms and were sold, and the children rarely ate the good food and the good vegetables, and thought a lot of that labor was exploitative of their time.
Yeah. These children, and I want to kind of focus on this point to highlight the way in which Canada and Canadian officials were thinking of these people, these children. The children were taken from their families to go to these schools in many, if not all cases. It seems to me that you can only do that if you're thinking of the parents as less than, as not equally human as the people who are in charge. This idea of splitting up families to send children to these residential schools / work camps really speaks volumes about what was happening and how egregious it was.
It was. It was setting up, or it was perpetuating an idea that Indigenous peoples in Canada or Indigenous peoples anywhere were somehow exactly that, less than human, or this kind of promoting the idea of savagery, of heathens, of kind of less than, and creating what would over time, over several decades, create kind of a class system or promote a class system in Canada, where even though the children inside the residential schools were being trained as farm hands and farm helpers, or as seamstress or a seamstress apprentice or carpenter's apprentice, that they weren't being trained to be in the regular workforce. They were trained to be the farm helper or the farm hand. They were being trained to be a second class of worker. And then when, you know, often people after they were discharged from the schools and returned home, they realized very quickly that they're living in a Canada and in a reserve system or in a, under the Indian Act, where they aren't able to be the farmer or the lead or the, or, you know, have jobs in the rest of Canada. They were really being trained to be a lower class of worker, of a different kind of stream of who was allowed to make money from agricultural goods or sell their goods. It was perpetuating in a different system, a completely different structure for Indigenous people in Canada.
Yeah. And as I said to begin, these schools are kind of at the root of the effort later, much later, to bring a commission together to kind of address a wide range of injustices that were inflicted upon Indigenous peoples. Walk us through that process. How does what happened in the residential schools become part of the impetus for this this truth and reconciliation effort?
A lot of that impetus came right from First Nations and Métis and Inuit communities and the survivors themselves. For decades, what happened in the schools, the realities of the conditions, the day-to-day conditions, starvation, malnutrition, physical and sexual abuse, student deaths, that was always known by students from the day that the schools opened. Kids were always going home to tell their parents and report what was happening. But through the 1980s, the 1990s, especially, survivors were gathering together. They were getting together at reunions, at the school reunions, or just in their local community, at the local band hall, in their homes, around kitchen tables. And they started increasingly sharing the stories of what happened to them and realizing that it wasn't only them that experienced those things, and started to pressure officials, church officials, government officials, for legal cases against some of the abusers, to kind of pressure against to create class action suits. And a lot of that was in meeting in groups and meeting in larger conferences and going through processes of healing, going through processes of kind of dealing with wellness and dealing with kind of intergenerational impacts of, this is, you know, generations of Indigenous people who they attended, their children attended, their grandparents and their great grandparents all attended the same schools, and how these intergenerational impacts from the schools were affecting their communities, and wanted people, the rest of Canada, to know what happened, to know the truth, because those truths had circulated inside the communities for as long as the schools were open. But really there was a kind of an unwillingness or unknowingness around the rest of Canada who didn't hear the truth or wasn't willing to hear the truth of what was really happening inside the schools.
And what's the reaction when this call to some form of justice gets made? You know, and I'm thinking here about an analogy to our country, the United States, and calls to reckon with our history and somehow make right what went wrong. When Indigenous people stand up and say, "Hey, look, this is going on. This is, you know, decimating our communities." What is the response from people in Canada?
It was a mixed response, and I think that was from the early time when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission started. That was some of the first conversations, and that was around 2008 and 2009. It was at the same time that the survivors kind of also requested or asked the government to issue an apology, a public apology in the House of Commons for residential school, for operating the residential school system along with the churches in Canada. And so the apology kind of, you know, in time led towards the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And what that was, some of the first conversations is how do we make this not just about Indigenous peoples, but about the rest of Canada? And how do you engage civil society, levels of government in Canada, churches in Canada, and the public in something that is much more than just Indigenous peoples, quote unquote, issues? Mm-hmm. It's about how we think about Canada, how Canada became a nation, how Canada operates today, the images of Canada as a human rights beacon and about social justice and human rights, and how this is much, much more than just about residential schools. It's taking a look at a lot of aspects of Canada. And part of the end of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada was to release 94 calls to action. And they were very broad. They were about the schools themselves, but they were about education, asking for calls to reforms in health and law and justice, mm-hmm. and in citizenship and sport and archives and museums. It called to almost every segment of Canada to look beyond just the residential school system and to look at Indigenous relations broadly.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Tricia Logan about Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. More Created Equal, and we're talking with Dr. Tricia Logan. She is a scholar who has experience working with Indigenous communities and residential school survivors in Canada. She held roles at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, and her research interests include residential schools, genocide, and settler colonialism. Dr. Logan, I want to talk more now about the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. How was this supposed to work? What power was it given? And was it enough? Was it given sufficient purview and ability to actually address the things that had been done in the past?
That's a good question. It was from about 2008 or 2009 till 2015, that was the length of the mandate the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was given. And often that was one of the critiques and good critiques of how long of a mandate they were given and how much work there was to do, because it was hosting national gatherings across Canada and also regional smaller gatherings to record statements and testimonies, both privately, where survivors and intergenerational survivors and some former staff members could sit down and record their experience, their stories, their oral histories. And then also publicly, there were public forums, the national gatherings and regional gatherings, to share publicly what happened, people's experiences and their thoughts, and kind of bridge those two parts of truth, sharing their truths and sharing what happened, as well as their vision for survivors' vision and Indigenous visions for what they thought reconciliation should be. And of course, the answer to that was very broad. Like, it was very individualistic almost. How, when asked that question, what do you see as reconciliation? Those answers were very broad. It was often about education and about letting the rest of Canada know about what happened in residential schools and what was happening broadly in Indigenous rights, and including that in school curriculum, like kindergarten to grade 12 curriculum, in university, post-secondary, in training professionals, in training public servants, in doctors and nurses, in legacies of colonial violence and residential schools, but also very connected structures of colonialism in Canada, like day schools and Indian hospitals and the child welfare system, and a series of kind of interlocked structures that were, you know, this was at the core of it about residential schools, but about a lot more Indigenous rights.
Yeah. So how much of what the commission was doing or supposed to do was about documenting the things that had happened before and making sure that, well, truth was brought to light about the nation's history? And then how much was about how to fix it, how to make things better for Indigenous people in the future?
It really was about striking that balance, about sharing the truths and having people hear the truths. As much as survivors were coming forward to share hours and hours, days of testimonies and oral histories and stories of often very traumatic, often very beautiful stories of strength and resistance and resilience. And in that, taking lessons from that strength and resistance and Indigenous resistance and asking what next, like where do we want these calls to actions to go? And it's been now almost a decade since 2015, the 94 calls to action were released. And that's a lot of people's reflection on it, is how many things that were called upon, all the different major calls, major changes, how many things have happened, mm-hmm. how many things have changed. And it's shifting that conversation. In May of 2021, into Kamloops to Shikwetmuk in British Columbia, there was a shift. The interim report on the findings in Kamloops on unmarked graves and missing children was released. And there was a different kind of public attention on all of the former sites of residential schools where there were unmarked burials and cemeteries. It kind of reignited a public Canadian broader conversation on, again, what happened at residential schools and what was being done, what kind of actions and reconciliation were being carried out or followed through, or those that weren't being done. That was as much as part of that conversation in acknowledging broader Indigenous rights battles for clean water, for land and resources, on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and a bigger conversation that we had to have in Canada.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Dr. Logan, this Truth and Reconciliation Commission goes through, documents all of these things that happen, and then comes up with what was going to happen as a result, right? What the country was going to do. Tell us what happens when they're finished and they decide to start trying to implement, or trying to get the government to implement this list of fixes.
I think the reaction was, at least from where I was, it was pretty broad. It was this kind of range of reactions, from no reaction at all to almost what in Canada has now manifested itself as denial of what happened, where there's kind of, you know, bubbling up racism and hatred that fuels denial that says none of it happened at all, which is one side of it. And then there's another side of it where there were segments of municipal, local, provincial, and federal governments that genuinely took a look at the way they were operating in partnership with, or not in partnership with, First Nations and Métis and Inuit people in Canada. And they tore up their policies. They revised policies that they looked at me with honesty as someone who had worked with residential school survivors. And they said, I think some of these policies were pretty racist. And they were right, but then they were willing to have really hard conversations about, we need to revise them, we need to change them, we need to throw them out. And I met with public servants who said, you know, I grew up in a little small town. There was a residential school in my town. I didn't really know what happened there. I had no idea. And I don't think what I've been doing for the last 30 years was pretty fair to Indigenous people. It was pretty awful. And I think I see why this requires change. This requires transformative change. And that's
So did that transformative change take place? It sounds like there was momentum to get it done.
There was momentum. It was groups, and that's not all government. It's not all provinces. It didn't happen very evenly in all areas. Some areas, you know, I also spoke to some people who kind of listened to those truths, listened about reconciliation, and just they were never going to engage from the start.
Sure.
And there was never going to be buy-in. But I did also meet with local governments, especially with teachers, with all levels of teachers who really wanted to teach different histories, have different conversations in their classrooms, talk about human rights, talk about social justice, talk about the way that it opened up conversations to a much broader conversation about discrimination and anti-racism, and had a much broader reach, where the core of it really was about residential schools, but there was a way for engaging in often difficult conversations, really hard truths directly with survivors and elders and Indigenous communities, with the rest of Canada, with especially churches, mm-hmm. church groups. I was asked to come speak at Mass. I was asked to speak to about these histories to church reading groups. There were lots of different kind of reconciliation reading groups that took up Indigenous authors and Indigenous literature and learned about not just what happened in residential schools, but broadly about Indigenous rights and local things that, you know, people would often come with that question. And it was a very genuine question, a very honest question. And often people kind of say, well, you have to do that work yourself, but they were good questions about what can we do? Like where do we start? There's 94 calls to action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is the work that needs to be done? And I would often answer that with kind of reading them,
That's right. Let's start there.
Learn about it. Learn about the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Learn about the National Inquiry on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. And somewhere in there, in 94 calls, there's something that connects with everyone about language, about health, about education, about the law. There's something in there that connects with nearly everyone that they have their own interest in. And there is actions that everyone can, you know, in a kind of a, you know, that's kind of a pie in the sky view of it. But
yeah, there was something for everybody, really.
Apathy and there was, you know, apathy and hatred and negative responses, violent responses, but there was also very meaningful and very respectful, thoughtful responses that carry on today.
Yeah. So the commission concludes its mandate in 2015. So that's just 7 or 8 years after it was created. Was that essentially claiming victory and saying, well, we faced this, we fixed it, and we can move on? Or was it more just kind of saying, well, we don't think we can go any further than they have? Talk about why the mandate ended, and especially because there were more testimonies and reports that have come out since them about the things that have gone on in Canada.
That's true. There's still survivors and intergenerational survivors that come forward even today to say they want to sit down and record their story for the first time, that 10 years ago or 10 years ago, they weren't at a place that they were ready to speak about it. So those testimonies and truths are still coming up. But I think the message that came out at the time, at the end of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because they were funded with a mandate that would end in 2015. I think that what was presented from the commissioners, the three commissioners of the TRC, and by survivors was, this is a this is a call. This is just the start. This is a call for transformative change. This is a call for change. And this is just the start of a conversation. And this is going to be decades. And a lot of the calls to action, some of them are worded that way, that they're looking at seven generations ahead. They're also looking seven generations before, but seven generations ahead of us. And it's going to take generations of work to kind of undo or to try to resolve some of what was what happened during the residential school eras, and what had happened in that relationship between Canada, its churches, its corporations, and Indigenous peoples in Canada.
Yeah. What if the Truth and Reconciliation Commission were still around, if it hadn't concluded its work in 2015? Do you think more would have changed? Do you think there would still be more momentum than there is now?
The end of the commission kind of marked a time where they, you know, they again made a call, 94 calls, and put this in the hands of not just Indigenous communities, but Canada, its churches, its corporations, to do that work, to do the hard work. And I think that survivors, especially survivors of residential school, Indigenous nations, keep carrying that message forward, and often kind of meet frustration because now there's a reflection back to 2015 on what was, like, there's good critiques on what was reconciliation meant to do. Was that reconciliation? Because there's, without justice, there's still violence. There's still massive resource extraction, water, like there's still removal of Indigenous presence from Canada. And there's kind of a very realistic conversation about, is reconciliation even possible? Is it even possible without, you have to lead with truth, you have to lead with justice, and without that, people say there's kind of precursors, there's kind of a lot of work that has to be done before they even enter a conversation about reconciliation. And that led into a conversation now about what happened in 2021, the start of kind of knowing more about the unmarked burials and grave sites, where there's now an Office of the Special Interlocutor on Missing Children and Unmarked Burials in Canada, that they've initiated national and regional gatherings across Canada to investigate. They hired an interlocutor to investigate what happened, and an Office of the Interlocutor to investigate and gather records. And so it's also survivors and Indigenous communities asking for more accountability and more justice of what happened to missing children and to what happened at residential schools. So it carries on. It kind of, it has a different kind of momentum and a different kind of meaning to the, especially the children who didn't make it home. And we're looking at the records that are required, the research. Some people are doing, some nations are leading that research on their own, on ground penetrating radar into the unmarked burials and the grave sites. And that will take, in some cases, decades for some of that research and work and hard work led by survivors and in respect of survivors. It's going to take, in some places, decades.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Dr. Tricia Logan about truth and reconciliation in Canada and here in America. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm talking with Dr. Tricia Logan, a scholar whose experience has been with working with Indigenous communities and residential school survivors in Canada. She's held roles at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation, and her research interests include residential schools, genocide, and settler colonialism. Dr. Logan, I want to talk now about what America, I guess, can learn from what happened in Canada. You know, we have had a conversation for a long time now about the things that were done to Indigenous people in this country. We, of course, have an awful history as well with things that have been done to African Americans. And we have never gotten to the point of establishing, you know, a body or an effort to really deal with what happened, documenting what happened, and then coming up with ideas for how to make up for those things. I wonder, from your seat in Canada, what you make of this kind of American struggle and how it differs from what you've been able to achieve there in Canada.
It is quite different. You're right. And that's in working in partnership for a long time with boarding school survivors from Indigenous nations that attended boarding schools and intergenerational survivors from boarding schools in the United States. It's a much different conversation, I think, in the U.S. in even having a conversation about truth and reconciliation or addressing those same kinds of hard truths that mm-hmm. happened about assimilation, about it is in a similar way kind of approaching a national narrative of the United States of how it became a nation, which I think Americans' relationship with that narrative is very present. Mm-hmm. It's very present in a way. And it's asking people to kind of revise that narrative. We always had a lot of American visitors, a lot of our relatives from the United States, from Native American and Indigenous communities in the United States, coming to Canada during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and afterwards to ask questions, to ask about how reconciliation was going, what did the work look like, how did we get to that part, to that point? Mm-hmm. And some people kind of even dismissing some of it and said, oh, they could never have those conversations. The same kinds of conversations about changing curriculum, adding Indigenous people's stories and Indigenous people's stories about residential school into kindergarten to grade 12 curriculum or post-secondary curriculum, having a specific call to all public servants to learn about legacies of residential schools and mm-hmm. settler colonialism, about anti-racism and discrimination, to put that out as a call to all levels of government. I think to some of our American colleagues seemed almost insurmountable from an Indigenous perspective, where they felt that they couldn't even start those conversations. So it was coming up, but I think increasingly there's always been groups of boarding school survivors who have a big voice and have kind of moved Indigenous rights forward to have those within their states, within their regions, within their local nations, to have those conversations locally, even though there isn't maybe a national conversation. That I think kind of a more specific or more regional conversations are happening. And there's gatherings of boarding school survivors and intergenerational survivors and Indigenous leaders across the United States who are really leading really important conversations that are perhaps analogous to the ones that were happening in Canada.
Yeah. One of the things that I observe as a difference, and I have to admit, I don't know as much about the history in Canada as I probably should. But one of the things that seems true is that in America, the relationship between the colonial settlers and Indigenous people ultimately became about genocide. It became about wiping out a population to make room for other people. And it was enormously successful. I mean, there are some 6 million indigenous people living here when the first European settlers arrive. That's down to, you know, under a million in the late 1800s, you know, 400 and some years later. And that population has grown again in the 20th century. It seems that in Canada, there's a more formidable presence still of Indigenous people that maybe makes it easier to have that voice, to demand a seat at the table, to determine how things are done. Am I wrong in that impression, or is that about right?
That's a good question, because it's about acknowledging genocide and settler colonial genocide on both sides kind of imaginary border. It's an amazing conversation for our families, our relatives that live on the border, who live on either side of that, are part of a nation that kind of cross borders between the United States and Alaska, mm-hmm. And Canada, mm-hmm. Where there, to some extent, there's political will in Canada or perhaps in the United States to hear Indigenous communities and welcome them to the table, where Indigenous communities in Canada still have to fight for that seat at the table and for that voice. But I know that Indigenous nations and Native Americans across the United States have been side by side and kind of asking for that space, asking for that voice, and kind of, I think what is being asked for broadly by Indigenous people everywhere is a nation-to-nation partnership, acknowledgement of their nationhood on their own as individual First Nations or individual sovereign nations, mm-hmm. and a seat at the table where their nationhood and their governance and their laws are acknowledged in the same spaces as state and federal and national governments are seated. I think that's the question. I think that's what's being led. And I think there's a huge voice in the United States and amazing thinkers and writers and Indigenous leaders in the United States leading that. But of course, there's a level of political will on the other side of the table that perhaps is a bit different between Canada and the United States.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to go back to the 94 calls to action that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada comes up with. And when they issue, there's a report that's done by the Yellowhead Institute that says that 13 of the 94 calls to action have been completed since 2015. And the report says that at that pace, it'll take another 58 years until all 94 are completed. And so that would mean that Indigenous people will have to wait until 2081 for this to take place. Is that a reasonable timeline? Is that about how difficult this all is? Or would Indigenous people be right to say, you know, that's a sign that maybe the commitment isn't as strong as it should be?
That's true. It is a reflection on commitment and or what has been done or actions that have been done to date. But it's also taking a look at the way, I think the way each one of the 94 calls to action, some of them genuinely are worded in a way that say this is in the next generation. That's the wording of them. And I think in some of the education calls to action, they call and recognize, and it's recognized from the outset that it will take a generation to do that work. So it's not as easy to kind of check them off a list, but keep monitoring. And I think there's something that the government of Canada hasn't done yet is reported fully on how they are accountable and how they are creating a national Committee for Reconciliation to monitor what's happening. Some governments have those kind of checks and balances and kind of yearly monitoring, because reconciliation or that work is going to look a little bit different every year. It's not going to look the same. And how to monitor that, how to kind of keep track of what's happening or not happening.
Is it solvable? I mean, is this something that could be fixed in Canada?
I think it's an interesting question too. And I think perhaps it is maybe analogous to the United States as well, to all of North America or all of the Americas. Is this relationship of settler colonialism and colonial incursions, is that it's not just about the residential school system. It's about so many interconnected structures of colonial control, about the Indian Act in Canada, the reserve system, the kind of oppressive legislation that was historic and carries on today. Not about the school system. It's, you know, we're learning about Indian hospitals in Canada that were a segregated system of hospitals in the name of protecting non-Indigenous populations. Like we're still learning about those histories, but also how those, you know, people, there's this negative rhetoric that says, oh, that's in the past, people need to get over it, and that's what our grandparents did to our grandparents. There's that kind of negative rhetoric around that, where a lot of these are still, it's not historic. It's not something that's in the past. It's very present. And I think that's, you know, it's a lot of different interlocking pieces that even if people are able to kind of confront histories of residential schools, there's so many other structures and histories that are deeply, deeply interconnected to them that it will take, again, generations of dismantling all of those pieces, all of those small pieces and big kind of macro, micro pieces of settler colonialism.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Tricia Logan, it was really great to have you here to share your knowledge and understanding about truth and reconciliation in Canada. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So 2081 for Canada, before Canada gets to the point where it has gone through this list of 94 calls to action.
That's the year that
they say could be done. Yeah.
It could be done.
It's a long time.
And I wonder if that's measured by the rate at which they're going currently.
It is.
Okay.
It's an extrapolation from what they've done in the last 9 years.
It's not quite a century after the last residential school. I believe that was in the 90s. So it would be just short of that. But that is a long time to take. And I guess the question is this going at the rate at which Indigenous peoples are comfortable with it? Are they seeing do they feel like Canada is reconciling at an appropriate rate?
Yeah. I mean, and that's always going to be a question. But again, I want to highlight the distinction here between the two countries. They're arguing about how quickly they can implement remedies for the things that were done. We haven't even gotten to the documentation stage of that process. And so we're really far behind, I think, is the only way to describe it when you think about how Canada has taken this on and decided to be better.
Yeah. Thank you for keeping us in check, because one thing we can definitely do is get ahead of talking about and analyzing another country's approach to something that we haven't even confronted.
That we've not even thought about.
Don't want to get too far ahead in there. But I also think about what the fact that there are still Indigenous communities in Canada. What she talked about was like how they were a large part of the effort to get this commission created to recognize that history. And so I think there's always in these conversations a moment where the folks who have been harmed have taken the burden of acknowledging it and bringing it to the forefront. And now it's now the duty of the folks who have the history of having done the harm to fix it, right? Like the Indigenous people shouldn't be responsible for carrying out every single step of these 94 calls to action. And so when it comes to here in this country, we shouldn't expect them to be the ones to have to start these calls to action.
That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org. And of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson, and our music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's public radio.